This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
They tried to make me go to rehab, I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
Good evening and welcome to Hooked, Joy 94.9's new program about addiction. Research shows that the LGBTI community has addiction problems of at least twice that of the general population, and we want to explore why and how this has come about. There are many suffering addiction, many more that are affected by those in active addiction, and people that are grateful in recovery. My name is David.
Good evening, my name's Russ. Now, what are some of the reasons behind this problem? Are there pathways towards recovery and change? How does addiction affect loved ones, family members, and partners of those in active addiction? You know, we're not experts here, David, in
no,
this
we're
field,
not.
But we are a couple of friends who both happen to be in recovery ourselves. We believe that there is a need for conversation in our community about addiction.
Yes, you're right. And if you'd like to join us in that conversation, you can SMS us anytime on 0427JOY949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au or hooked@joy.org.au. We've got our own email address. If you're experiencing immediate problems or if content of this program raises issues that cause distress, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or lifeline.org.au or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36 beyondblue.org.au. So we've got a pretty jam-packed show tonight.
It's very exciting, isn't it, David? I know tonight we're going to be talking about psychoactive substances.
Yes, and of course,
what else
are we going to be talking
about?
And
we're going to be talking a very important addiction, self-harm. So before we start the show this evening, I think it could be good if anyone out there would like to send in a question or questions about self-harm or psychoactive substances. Again, those numbers that they can reach us on are
0427JOY949. That's it. Or onair@joy.org.au, of course.
Exactly. Both very important topics tonight, and thank goodness we've got experts in that we can discuss this matter with.
Now, also, tonight, we do have a guest to do with self-harm, but we also have the debut tonight of Nurse Betty.
Oh, isn't she fabulous?
I know she is. And Nurse Betty is going to be presenting.
I've seen her credentials.
Do you know what Nurse Betty's going to present?
Addiction of the Week.
Good evening, Nurse Betty. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah. I'm very well indeed, thank you. Now, just to qualify, you are a nurse.
Kind of comes with the title, I think.
Exactly.
Yes, I'm a nurse. I work in mental health.
Good.
And I work in, a lot of our work is with co-occurring illnesses. Used to be known as dual diagnosis, mental health and substance misuse or substance use.
Okay, and tonight we're going to talk about psychoactive substances. And a psychoactive substance, in case anybody's wondering, is any drug or food that affects mental ability, activity or processes, or mood. And that goes really basically from caffeine to heroin. But what are you going to talk about tonight, Nurse Betty?
We're going to talk about, well, I'm going to talk about specifically what they call the new psychoactive substances that fall basically into four categories. You've got your stimulants, you've got your hallucinogenics, and the hallucinogenics are psychedelics, N-bomb, 5-MeO Dalt and 2C, and the dissociatives such as Mixi. So then you've got your stimulants, your hallucinogenics, then you've got your depressants, and they're mostly the opioids. You'll have heard of drugs like fentanyl. There's a lot of they're called analogs, but they're versions of a substance.
Are they mainly just prescription type?
No, not at all. No, these are fentanyl is a drug that's used as an anesthetic in surgery. In fact, I had some myself. I had this thing on my head was treated, and I was put out with fentanyl, and I could totally understand why people get addicted to it.
Right.
And then there are the benzos. The other depressants are the diclazepam. You'll have heard of diazepam, but diclazepam, flubromazepam. So there's a range of drugs that actually put, they kind of lower people's moods and you know, make them, they used to be known as anxiolytics, but they kind of calm people down.
So they're the depressants?
There are, well, no, these are all psychoactive substances. Okay. So the names are different. There's names like Spice, K2. We're talking about, because of the fourth category that I haven't mentioned yet is the cannabinoids.
Uh-huh.
And that's the synthetic cannabis stuff that was used before 2017 was known as legal highs, herbal highs, party pills, you know, those kinds of things, which in 2017 were all made illegal. They were legal. You could buy them from sex shops and places like that, but now, in Australia in 2017, there was a new law passed which made them all illegal.
Now, cannabinoids, I am in recovery myself, mm-hmm. and met a man who was totally addicted to cannabinoids.
Yep.
What is the attraction? Is it? I get the whole thing about smoking marijuana and what that does to you, but what are the effects and what should be avoided with regards to cannabinoids?
Well, to be honest with you, the fact that the cannabinoids are synthetic, which means that they're man-made, then cannabis is a natural, it's a plant. It grows in nature,
and that's they're used for recreation and health.
And it's used for a lot of things, and we know that the chemical makeup of cannabis is really complicated.
Yes.
There's a lot of belief that the media kind of say things like cannabis can't cause psychosis, but for some people it can. And what we know is that we all react very differently and we all have very different tolerances and, you know, thresholds for things like psychosis.
Well, yeah, you only need to meet perhaps a long-term user that
yep.
has actually been using ever-increasing amounts over a very long period, and,
yep.
and that psychosis is pretty evident.
It is, but it's not guaranteed.
No.
It doesn't happen to everybody. It's the same with all the, you know, not everybody that smokes get cancer. My mum was close to 50 a day up until mm-hmm. the 60s, mm. and she's never had an episode of cancer in her life. She stopped smoking when she was in her 60s because she had a heart attack, which was possibly, you know, exacerbated by the smoking, but no cancer, no lung disease. What we know is that nobody is affected the same. And the people, as much as we know, there are people who use cannabis who become psychotic, who mm-hmm. need more and all that, the addictive kind of tendencies. There are also lots of people who use it without ill effects, without major side effects.
It's funny, Nurse Betty, because you're talking about the cannabinoids and certainly the synthetic ones.
Yeah.
Is this what we're talking about as far as medicinal cannabis is concerned?
No.
Is that synthetically produced?
No. The stuff that they're using for medicinal cannabis is plant grown. It's the stuff that occurs in nature.
So where does synthetic cannabis come from?
Well, synthetic cannabis was kind of created. I'm not 100% sure of the history, but it was created out of, these drugs have been around for a long time. So you'll have heard of Meow Meow, Mephedrone. That first synthesized in 1929.
Wow. Oh.
So it's been around for a very long time, but it kind of had a resurgence. And the interesting thing about these drugs is, like, for instance, BZP or BZP, benzyl piperazine, was first used as a livestock wormer, right? And it was commonly used on farms. It was used for pigs. It was used. But the bit that I find fascinating and strange is this idea of who was it that first thought, oh, livestock wormer, I'll give that a go.
Yeah, you know, I'm a farmer. I'm just going to give this a go.
Yeah.
Wow, this is fantastic. Hey, I might sell it to my friends.
Did he spill a bit on his finger?
Don't
you know?
Well,
did
no, I think I can help you both out there.
Yeah.
Because what happened, I agree with you, who would have been the farmer that would have taken it? However, what did happen was these guys all got published, these scientists.
Right.
And so in the journals that these scientists published were actually how this thing was made and what the side effects were.
Right.
Then the naughty people out there decided, well, I might try
that
again. And I'll give that a go. And they had their homemade labs even way back in the 20s and the 30s.
Yeah.
And they mass produced.
You're sure it wasn't a case of, oh, I'm a little bit itchy, I might have worms?
No. I wish it was that simple. Okay. I wish it was. But they did get published in medical journals, and that's what was born from those medical journals. The naughty people read those journals, and then they made their own little labs in a way.
But who worked out what they did? This is the bit that I find fascinating.
Well, the scientists, I believe.
So they were experimenting.
Yeah, they were experimenting way back then.
I know there was I know we're not talking about it tonight, but I know there was a video, and you can actually find this on YouTube. I think it was the British Army used LSD, and they were looking at it.
Many of the
and there's
did.
There's a video clip where they actually sent these soldiers off on a reconnaissance mission, or it was a pretend mission, but they gave them all LSD, and within sort of like an hour or so, the mission had gone to pieces, and people were sitting in the grass looking at trees and things like that.
So tell me, Nurse Betty, when do these psychoactive substances become a problem?
I would say, and you know, you've got to remember that what I do for work is this kind of conversation. We have these conversations all the time. And my personal opinion, and it's not something that I'm necessarily 100% sure of, but I generally tend towards the idea that they're a problem if they cause you a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If they interfere with your life. Well, we talk about the difference between neurosis and psychosis. We're all a bit neurotic. If you think about things like OCD, you know, we can all worry about, did we turn the iron off? You know, have we locked the door? Those kinds of things. And we know we did. You know, we might have a picture of it. But it becomes problematic if you can't get out the house because you need to wash your hands 200 times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or you can't get to work because you keep going back to check. So my sense, and again, this is just personal take on it, is if you can enjoy life, people drink, people smoke, and it doesn't cause you problems, so be it. When they cause you problems, when your life turns to shit, when you can't hold down a relationship, when you can't keep a job, those are the kinds of times that substance use. And, you know, once upon a time we talked about substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
The PC world that we live in now, we don't talk about abuse anymore because the idea of someone abusing anything or anyone is really not recovery focused. It's not good for people. It's not good for their self-esteem. So the language that we use now is substance use and substance misuse.
Yeah. So it's more to do with when these substances start to take over life. I mean, for instance, if somebody was taking something once on the occasional weekend, that possibly, I mean, I'm not going to condone it, but
no.
At the same time, it isn't necessarily seen as a problem. But when you get to the end of a whole weekend of use, and all you're looking forward to after the remorse and the regret on the Monday morning of having to go back to work, and all you're looking forward to is Friday,
the next weekend,
then obviously there must be some sort of serious problem coming up. Because
yeah.
In our community, as a gay community, where you know, people constantly say, oh, yeah, well, they really like to party and they like to party hard.
Yeah.
But there's not exactly a fine line. There's a line between where it goes from that to the abuse, I suppose.
But then we get into the whole kind of mental health stuff around, mm-hmm. you know, what's driving that behaviour? What is it that causes someone to live, you know, from Friday to Sunday and then exist from Sunday to Friday?
Yeah.
You know, there's reasons, and we know that, you know, the therapies and all mental health is really... Substance use is one of the mental health challenges that people deal with. And our communities struggle. You know, we're from day one, we're taught, maybe not so much now, but our generation particularly, we were taught that we're not right, that we're not like others. We don't fit, we don't belong, we're not good enough. It's no wonder that a lot of people grow up damaged.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you with regards to your... statement about how, you know, synthetic cannabis now is illegal.
Yep.
So that then, in my mind, and I'll try anything once, so I'm one of those, you know.
There's no such thing as a safe drug. Let's be clear about that.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. But isn't that then dangerous now that it's no longer legal? Because you're looking at then, you don't know where these things are being made, so it's then pushed all the way back to backyard labs and all of that sort of stuff. So
totally.
Now you, whereas before, previously, was it safer to use or...
Well, I'll just repeat, there's no such thing as safe drugs, but they were manufactured, they came with labels, you know, what was on them, you know, was known.
Yes.
But you really, I mean, you're on the edges of the whole thing about the war on drugs.
Yes.
Did prohibition work?
No.
Of course it didn't, but we still practice prohibition on all the other substances.
And then we can get into the whole debate about, which we've seen a lot of on the news over the last week or so, which is about pill testing. And
yep.
Really, you know, I mean, that's another can of worms, and there's different opinions on both sides. Look, we're going to come back in a moment, and we're going to talk to our guest about self-harm after this break.
On Joy.
You're listening to Hooked with Dave and Russ. Joy 94.9's program about addiction. If you're experiencing immediate problems, or if the content of this program raises issues that causes distress, you can call Lifeline on 131114. That's Lifeline on 131114. Or you can call Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36. That's 1300 2246 36 for Beyond Blue. Dave.
You are getting better at this.
I'm trying to. It's not easy being an evening DJ. I'm used to lunchtime on a Saturday okay. when I'm wide awake. But gosh, this show, this program is much needed in the community. What are we discussing tonight, please, David?
Well, as we mentioned before, we're going to talk about self-harm. If you do have any questions or if you have any input, 0427JOY949 if you want to send a text. Now, people define self-harm in lots of different ways. Usually self-harm is defined as someone deliberately hurting themselves without wanting to die. It's sometimes called deliberate self-injury or non-suicidal self-injury. Engaging in self-harm may not mean that someone wants to die. It's a behaviour that's used to cope with difficult or painful feelings. Tonight, we're joined by Tosh. Welcome to Joy 94.9.
G'day, how are you?
It's great to have you here. Look, we really appreciate you coming in to talk about self-harm. I thought I'd open up. We've got Nurse Betty on hand because, as Russ and I constantly say, we're not experts in this field. But, like, at what sort of age did you start harming yourself?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I'm very glad you began with the stingers about, because this is a topic that I have found, and through talking anecdotally, that is an issue of extreme graphic nature and one that's very easily triggered. So I'm trying to be very conscious to be, but let's put it this way. My first attempt on my own life was at aged 8. And self-harm became a thing later on. I used to enjoy picking at myself through high school, but I'll tell you what, it's a little bit like, could you ever remember your first drink? Could you ever remember your first time having a cigarette? A little bit like that. I don't remember the first time, but I remember the first time I experienced it and didn't want the feeling to go away. I just finished high school. I felt very much on my own. I didn't know where I was going in life. For some reason, that thought appeared in my mind. To harm, and from there it was almost a daily thing for the next 4 years, or 3-odd years after that. And this was in when I was 18 years old, so 2015, yeah.
You could hear a pin drop in the studio at the moment because, I mean, it's just awful that you were at that stage, even at 8 years old, and then to continue on. I noticed that research shows that for each age group, female rates of self-harm exceed that of males, and the highest rates for females are in the 13 to 24 age group, and for males between the 12 and 34 age group, so a little bit longer in males. Is that the sort of thing that, Nurse Betty, you would find in cases that would present to you?
We tend not to see that kind of stuff in child services. I'm almost as impressed and fascinated by this subject as you are, because my experience with self-harm is typically as a symptom of a borderline personality disorder, which gets a lot of bad rap. It's one of the most challenging mental health issues that people have to deal with. In my years of working, I wouldn't have seen any, literally any, kids of that age, because my work has been mostly in the youth, adolescents, and adult areas, but I'm not familiar with this as an addiction.
But at the same time, it's something, Tosh, that you would be certainly keen to hide.
Yeah, I mean, part of me is deeply surprised by that concept that you could work in this field and not be shown about it. But I mean, part of the reason why I'm here is, well, it's very difficult to talk about, but thinking back on my childhood and into my later years to now, it was a story I never heard.
Mm.
And it was a story I very much identify with that concept of dual diagnosis. I was a sick man on very, very many fronts. But of all the things that I wanted to hide, this was it.
Mm.
It was the hardest thing to hide.
Yep.
And it was the thing that carried the most shame. And I tried very hard to hide it for a long time.
And it was interesting that you talked about the idea of being, your recollection of being really lonely and being very isolated, because one of the current beliefs, strong beliefs when we're working with substance misuse, is there's a quote that flies around: the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection.
Mm.
And it's a Johann Hari quote, the guy that wrote Chasing the Scream. And it just speaks to so many of the guys and many of the people that we worked with, that the journey to addiction is a journey of pain and a journey of loneliness and sadness.
Mm.
Whatever the addiction is, you know, whatever the source is. What we know when we listen to people's stories is they're talking about hurt. Mm. They're talking about pain. So when we get the rampant sort of right-wing nasty people saying, you know, horrible things, they're actually victimizing victims. You know,
yeah.
They're already the people who end up, the people who are on the streets, the people who are, you know, struggling with their use, those are already people that are extremely badly damaged and hurt.
Yeah. Now, I've got stupid question number one. Tosh, how does pain make you feel good?
Good is such an operative term. It made me feel right. It was the desired... the word, it made me feel like a person again, gets thrown around a lot.
Mm.
I'm not so sure about that, because I'm not damn sure I didn't ever feel like I wanted to be a human, but it felt correct.
Yeah.
And once you find something that makes you feel more like you have this sense that you want to be, then you... I mean, I'll put this out here openly. I was as surprised as anyone when I discovered that, as I mentioned before, I had another, like, a completely separate addiction to go with it. And when I discovered, after entering recovery for that I was very much hooked on my own terms to self-harm, I was shocked. I didn't know how... It was a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
That I didn't realise how... I just assumed they were correlated, but it was its own thing, and it was its own journey now to keep away from.
Yeah, absolutely. Tosh,
can I just interrupt and ask, what did you do to yourself, and what made you choose that form of self-harm? And you don't have to answer any questions.
No. Of course. What did I do to myself? Well, it started off with, you know, and again, I'm apologising if this is... you know, too graphic in advance to anyone, but, you know, I started off with knives because that's what I had on hand. And in many ways, like we say to ourselves, oh, no, I don't want to move on to smoke cigars. No, I don't want to move on to drink bourbon at 9 a.m. in the morning. I said, no, I don't want to be that guy who uses razor blades. Well, yeah. I mean, it turned into that very rapidly because it was just an effect that I tried once and couldn't give up.
Mm.
You know, it was, it was cleaner. It was, and, you know, you want to talk about, you know, sickness and my mental obsession with this thing. I thought it was the right way to do it.
Mm.
Thought it was the cool way to do it. Well, there was, of course, no right way to do it. There was no healthy way to do it at all. But my mind was tricking myself into basically finding any way to continue that.
Okay, I've actually got stupid question number two, which I wrote down earlier. Did you have, and I don't know, hopefully this isn't distressing, but did you have a little kit? Did you bring it out? What did it consist of?
Like,
were there favourite instruments?
Yeah, look, I really don't want to give anyone ideas. So I will say, I will say, yes, I did. I considered it very ritualistic up to a point, up to the latter months of my drinking, and certainly the worst months of my self-harming. That ritual went out the door, but before then, and again, it comes back to those analogues. It was, it's a special occasion. I'll make a special deal out of it. Mm. Well, it wasn't very long until every day was a special day, was it? So, yeah, but, you know.
Did it take away the emotion and the pain?
Yes. It's funny. It's not easy for me to be talking about this, obviously. I mean, again, I'm motivated.
It's pretty brave.
Well, I'm motivated by that reminder that, you know, when I was there, I felt so alone.
Yeah.
And having had anyone talking about it would have been a damn sight better than no one talking about
it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sorry, what was the question? I'm a bit sick, everyone. Sorry.
No, you're perfectly fine. People in addiction are running away from feelings and emotions.
Oh, yes.
So I was just curious: did it take away the pain that you were feeling with emotions and feelings?
It was this cross dimensional thing. It was I wanted it to remind myself that I could feel pain, because I very like early on I only did it when I was pretty well numbed out by other things anyway, but you know, at the end of the day it was almost like this test, it did come to remove the pain, which was weird, but it was that kind of anxiolytic, like I this is my pain as a human. It was the pain was taken away in that I was finally feeling like I was right. Yeah, that conceptual existential anxiety was removed instead by real pain.
And it speaks really clearly. I worked with the thing I remember most about working with people who self-harm, a young woman in her 20s, 23, 24. She and I were talking one night about how when she's in a dark space, her life was peppered with episodes where she would become what she called them her dark spaces. And she said, when I'm in my dark space, I am numb. I am completely numb. I have no feelings. Mm. I can go through days of not even knowing whether I'm alive or not. Mm. And she said, when I hurt myself, when I see the blood, at least I know I'm alive.
Yeah. Let's and that's just a pretty take a strong little bit of a break because it is getting a little bit heavy.
Yeah. Well, it certainly sorry. Is.
But I think we before we do that, we should clarify the fact that, you know, we have got really heavy here. But Tosh, you got help and everything is absolutely great for you today. And we're going to come back and talk about that more after the break.
I'm,
This is Hooked on Joy 94.9.
Yes, it is. You are listening to Hooked with David and Russ, Joy 94.9's program about addiction. If you're experiencing immediate problems or if content of this program raises issues that cause distress, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36 because we are talking about self-harm tonight. And our guest is Tosh, who is relating his story about self-harm. And also we have Nurse Betty on hand as well in case Russ or myself need to get some nursing help. Yeah, exactly.
You know, did I tell you guys that I failed my CPR?
Okay. Well, Tosh, hopefully you heard something happen.
Oh, it's been a while.
Now, it's been quite a graphic conversation about your self-harm and what you actually did. Mm. I was wondering whether, does it tie back in with your sexuality?
Well, I mean, I mentioned before the break that it was about this feeling of, and I mean, I'm not relating on behalf of all people who, this is a very complex matter and it happens for all sorts of reasons. And that's what other sufferers have, related to me. But let's just put it this way, around about the time that I started so earlier on in high school, where do I find myself? I find myself pining after a woman and then also falling in love with a boy in the hockey team. I mean, it was not this great mix for feeling involved and, you know, at the right place in high school. I'd moved a staggeringly large amount as a child. My family was in the military. We moved around a lot. I didn't have a lot of time to discover who I was as a person, and then I did a lot of discovering at once, and it wasn't very comfortable. And let's just put it this way, it built up to this fact that for, well, until I entered recovery, I never felt right about who I was as a person. And I'm not saying that anyone in my youth, you know, said to me, you are wrong as a person or anything like that, but, you know, I was different. I was different from the people around me. I was different from the kids who I hung out with. And I was used to dealing with those problems on my own, and I didn't have those problems to anyone else. That, I'm sure nobody needs reminding, is not a great way to deal with any anxieties or mental concerns.
No, guaranteed to make everything worse.
Yeah.
So, Tosh, what made you reach out in the end then? You're, you know, you've said that you felt different, which caused you to self-harm. Mm. What made you reach out in the end? What was your rock bottom, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. I had my progress, my descent, I should almost definitely say, was incredibly rapid from the end of high school until age 20. Was monumentally fast. And as a result, I still had people left in my life who hadn't given up on me yet. And for that, I was incredibly lucky. But, I mean, I did want to mention, like, it's, you know, we've been talking a lot about substance use on this show, and I'll relate an anecdote that, you know, puts, which makes me feel comfortable relating these stories on a show about substance use. Like, I remember speaking to my partner late one night, coming into August or September 2017, and her saying desperately, I'm going to take the razor blades away. And I turned to them and, you know, pretty violently said, if you take them away from me, I'll just smash this bottle open and use that instead. Mm-hmm. You know, it. And when I came into recovery, when I got home from rehab, I threw out the drug paraphernalia, the bottles, quick smart, but it took me 3 weeks to throw out the razor blades.
Mm.
I did not feel comfortable without them in the house.
Yeah.
How did I get into recovery? I was saved. I was put into rehab, and that jolt was so sharp. In between suffering to all of a sudden being, I mean, coddled a bit in rehab, but all of a sudden just not in immediate danger, that I just happen to hang on for dear life. I mean, I will openly admit that fear saved me for a long, fear of going back to how I was, mm-hmm. saved me for a long time in those first few months until I could get it together to build the life that I saw other people had for myself. But, you know, I was just lucky. I did reach out. I said to my partner, I can remember saying, "That's it. I'm done." I was giving away all my things. I was giving away my money. I didn't think I would make it to my 21st birthday. I remember attending dinner for my 21st and it being a very awkward affair. I didn't know what to say. I never planned to get that far. But, I mean, just think about that. Like, I still had people to go to a birthday dinner with. I was lucky and I reached out and I just said, luckily, not just to myself but to another person, enough is enough.
And did that person know that you were self-harming?
My partner absolutely did. They were fiending after it for years. Mm. They knew I'd been, and I put them through absolute torture. But luckily, my mother was in the picture, and she works in health.
Yep.
She didn't have an idea at all, but the benefit, again, chance, grace, whatever you want to call it, when she found out, it was straight back to being a doctor. It was logistics, triage, all the things that needed to get me in right away.
So was the rehab actually a circuit breaker? And what happened in there that actually broke that cycle?
Well, it's funny because I'm on here to talk about self-harm, and that cycle didn't actually end in rehab. Because going into rehab, I was diagnosed borderline psychotic going in. I was hearing things, I was seeing things that weren't real. I was really at the end of my rope. And it was what I needed. Detox, it's a bit weird to think about now because it's what feels like such a strange portion of my memory, but it was exactly that. It was a break. It was the longest break I'd ever taken off any kind of substance. I think in the period of use for all sorts of things, the longest break I had was altogether I had about 4 or 5 days. Wow. Of no substances.
In your journey, Tosh, has there ever been a why or a why me factor to the recovery?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we've come out of a very difficult period, haven't we? Anybody who's listening to this show and related to any part of it will need no reminding that we've just come out of a very difficult period for two reasons. There's the pressure to have fun and the fact that, you know, everybody's putting on their best. Either putting it on or not putting it on, that's true, but you're just seeing it, right? You know, you're exposed to the...
So social media.
Yeah, yeah, and just spending time with people who are having fun, and certainly I sit there and I go, well, why can't I be like them?
Yep.
Ordinary people. Mm. I don't know what's going into these people's heads. None of us do.
Who's lying?
Yeah, well, correct.
Because yeah, yeah.
God knows I did. But you sit there and you go, why can't I enjoy my life like these other people? But Christ, I mean, I'm still too early on in this pace of my life to make any comment as to why, but I must be on it for a reason. It's a damn sight better than the cards I were dealt previously.
Mm.
So if it has to be me, I guess we do the hard things and keep working on it day by day in order to, you know, maintain any semblance of, you know, being you know, just a happy member of society. Not even a member of society, just be happy.
Yeah,
go live in a forest, I don't care. Just be a happy person.
And you talked about your family. Were they, like, and again, you don't have to, we haven't negotiated whether this is an okay area. but were your family around? Have they been significant players in it? Or
In recovery, not so much. Not so much. They're there for me and it's a wonderful thing. But not so much. No, no.
Okay.
I mean, if you've got them around, they love you. It's wonderful. But I mean, no, that's a weird one. I don't really consider that much. I have them more in my life now than I did. That's a great thing. But it's no, I wouldn't call it. It was the last thing I was thinking about when I was drinking, drugging, and harming. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I think there's this kind of Walton's, you know, idea that families are always perfect and they'll always love you and they'll always accept you.
Well, they can look perfect.
Exactly. And we know how true that really is for most people.
Yeah, that's right, John Boy and Nurse Betty. We're going to come back in a moment after this break.
On Joy.
Yes, you are listening to Hooked on Joy with Russ.
And Dave.
Yes, that's right.
Tosh, a quick question before we move on to Hope.
Yes.
Your drinking, drugging and self-harming, did you see all of that as interrelated and intertwined? Was one connected to the other? And
I did, and that's why I mentioned earlier that I was as shocked as anybody else to find out it was an independent thing which required its own independent work to stop.
Yeah.
I can tell you now I have self-harmed more recently than I've had a drink or a drug, I can tell you that. And that shocked me, I did see it as all intertwined, and more importantly, you know, part of me was furious when my life got better, when I gave up the drink specifically, because I didn't want it to be that.
Right.
I was furious that it wasn't everything else I'd built up all my problems to be.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I remember.
And society doesn't help with that either.
No, and you know, I'm a young man. I'm 21 now. It was not the outcome I wanted to discover that I couldn't have a nice, you know, cold pinger on the weekend, you know. But yes, it was all intertwined, but then it wasn't in recovery. You know, it was a particularly nasty situation because exposure to any one of those three things led to all three of those things.
Right. Yeah.
But in recovery, they're their own beasts that require their own, you know, work to cessate. Yeah.
And if you take drugs and alcohol out of the picture,
yeah,
you're still going to be feeling emotions.
Oh, yeah.
Feelings.
Yeah.
So maybe it was just a hangover from that sort of area if you continued with the self-harm.
Well,
your old friend.
Yeah, it was. It was one of those things. I told myself, I'm thinking of one specific occasion that I won't go into detail about, other than, well, it was interesting because we talk about these kind of triggers, and it was for me, I was at work, I sustained a small cut on my hand, and I was very, you know, just a nick that I sustained through my line of work, and I was having a not great week. I didn't think of taking a substance at all, but within about 5 to 10 minutes, I was in the work bathroom with a tomato knife, you know, and it just got me. Just like that. And it was that, you know what, we've all told ourselves many lies, but the lie I told myself then was, oh, it's not like the others. It's not going to ruin my life. How insane is that? The lie I told myself about cutting myself, and apologies again to keep going back to that, but was that it's not harmful for me, unlike the other substances.
But you believed it.
I did.
Yes.
In an instant, it was all I needed to hear, and it was the obsession was there in a heartbeat, yeah, and unable to be stopped.
And I think, I'm oversimplifying this by a million miles, but it falls into the category of immediately you tell someone, don't do something. You know, don't do this. Don't drink. Don't have that extra drink. Mm. Don't have the extra pills. Don't hurt yourself. Mm. The minute you tell somebody that, you've lost them. Mm. You stop trying to engage with them and listen to them and to hear what it is that they're trying to tell you.
Mm. Correct.
It's funny, I've been looking at the, we mention Lifeline quite often as one of the great support services that are available to anybody 24/7. And, you know, it's crisis support and suicide prevention. They have actually got a section on self-harm, and they have got a few suggestions for people that may actually be having difficulty. I mean, it's an amazing resource, and it's not necessarily going to be a cure, but it would probably help people. Mm. They say, number one, to talk to someone that you trust. Mm. Number two, to recognise when you do and don't self-harm. Number three, to distract yourself. Well, that's probably easier said than done, but nevertheless, they put that in there. Number four, to write it down, which would be keeping some sort of self-harm diary. And number five, to get help by visiting your GP, who would probably refer you on somewhere else. What do you think of those sorts of suggestions, Nurse Betty?
Look, I think the issue is really about the externalising of what's going on is really important. So the journaling and the diary and writing things down is about getting, you know, the inner turmoil and the inner turbulence out. But what we're talking about really is the idea. I sit here and I'm listening to Tosh talking about self-harm and hurting himself, wondering how many people, and if people who are listening or people who heard him tell the story, their immediate reaction would be, oh my God, he's hurting himself, we've got to stop him. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's completely the wrong thing to do, because the minute you focus on the behavior, you stop listening and stop hearing the problem.
Well, those sorts of suggestions are really for the person that may actually be isolating. I expect self-harmers would isolate as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we can't forget also, you know, such as your partner, because we've talked about it before on this program, that there are people that are affected by those with those sorts of tendencies in addiction. And they're the people that also really need to look after themselves as well.
Yeah.
So, Tosh, out of curiosity, you know, one of the things that we recognise that people who would be listening to this show is that fear around seeking help.
Yeah.
Now, did you feel judged? Were you afraid to seek help? And how did you find the resources that were at your disposal?
Absolutely, I felt afraid. Specifically, I think there were so many fears tied up in it, but I think the one in hindsight that was most prevailing was the idea that if I talked to somebody about it, they'd take it away from me.
Right.
And I did not know how to conceptualize a life without it, as is the case for so many different types of addictions. But, and speaking about if there's anyone listening who was or is affected by this, then if there's half of the reason why I'm here is to say two words, and that's, or a couple of words, and that's just say talk to somebody, anybody.
Mm. And also that you're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, to have heard, I'm not saying that I'm some, you know, great orator of the times, but if I had have heard my own story at any point, or just any story that was like that came to explain a little bit of how I felt at the time, like, just it would have helped. Anything that would have helped. It's stigma affects all facets of LGBT life. Bloody the lives of those affected by drug and substance abuse. But you know, in my head, this self-harm, this crippling, like, kind of just depressive cycle seems to be affected by the stigma so much more in my head. I don't know why. I obviously can't corroborate that. But it's, there's no, you know, sadder memory in my mind than, you know, some of those nights alone. You know, it's a place I would truly wish upon nobody. And so much of that is helped, not everything, but so much of it is helped by just talking to someone else, because you're not on your own.
This was something we talked about certainly when we covered 12-step programs before Christmas, where people were actually identifying with other people that are in a similar situation, and that was certainly part of the pathway to their recovery, because they realised that they're not alone. And that's something that we talk about often on this program, is that nobody's alone, and they have to need, all they need to do is just take that first step and reach out.
I love that concept that the message that is, you know, you're giving is talk to people. And I also think, you know, for anybody who's listening, who's helping or around someone who's self-harming, my biggest word of advice, and I'd be interested to hear what you think, is, you know, like, just don't run for the hills, you know, like, stay with them, don't go running for help. Obviously life preservation is the key thing, but staying there and not reacting to the self-harm is a really key message.
Well, I mean, I guess you're right. You know, life preservation is the first thing, right? Where it's obviously, you know, if you're a bystander and sort of a loved one or something, and it is something seriously concerning, then put it out of your hands, and it's not worth your risk. Get them the help that. And this is what I kind of mean for the affected, for the sufferer to reach out, because the more people know, it can be so difficult to have any sort of agency when you are suffering, and even one word can set off a, you know, a chain that the person you're speaking to is unlike. And just briefly mentioning 12-step programs, like, I'm not aware of one for this particular thing, and, you know, the person you might not be talking to probably has no experience with it. But they might know someone who can help you better.
Yeah.
And that chain begins. We just, you know, because I guess it comes back to how's it going on your own? Solving it, you know? It's something, I guess, speaking of hope, it can be something that is no longer part of your life. It can stop. Yeah. It requires work, but it can be a thing of the past.
Look, we have to thank you so much, Tosh, for coming in, telling such an honest and candid story about
incredibly brave.
That's something that we'd like to encourage here on Hooked, because it is a safe space as well, an important thing. Thank you so much, also, Nurse Betty, for being here tonight.
Thank you for having me.
As we say, Russ and I certainly aren't experts, but it's great to have Nurse Betty.
You know the definition of an expert, don't you? X is an unknown quantity, and a spurt's a drip under pressure.
Yeah, that's true. We hope that you've enjoyed tonight's show, and remind you that if you're experiencing immediate problems, or if content of this program raises issues that cause you distress, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36.
It is important to move away from self-destructive reasoning. Recovery involves breaking the cycle of addiction, removing the trigger of negative thinking, and restoring us to emotional sobriety. One of the greatest highs in life is feeling good about ourselves. ourselves. Always remember that none of us are alone in this world and that the first step in recovery is to ask for help.
We want our community to be one of hope and look forward to your company next week as we continue to explore addiction on Hooked. Meanwhile, it's goodbye from Russ.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, David. Goodbye.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.